Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee's 2010 Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer, was widely acclaimed as an illuminating examination of this complex of diseases that continues to frighten and worry the public, bedevil researchers and doctors, and despite the huge sums of money devoted to its eradication, and the disease's seemingly wily ability to adapt to any effective treatment. When Ken Burns and his Florentine Films decided to adapt the book for PBS, he turned to documentary filmmaker Barrett Goodman to lead the project. And next Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, PBS will air his six-hour documentary, Cancer, the Emperor of All Maladies. Barrett Goodman is the producer, director, and co-writer of the films. He's a veteran documentary maker whose films include Scottsboro, An American Tragedy, Clinton, and Makers, Women Who Make America, as well as numerous episodes of PBS's The American Experience and Frontline. In Cancer, he tells the stories of the advances and setbacks in the battle against this disease with many of the researchers, Nobel laureates, who made the breakthroughs, how cancer was mentioned or avoided in popular culture, and the battle over cigarettes' role in lung cancer. This historical view is balanced by contemporaneous stories of cancer patients and doctors, one at a leading cancer research facility and the other at an everyday hospital. In a touching irony, the film is narrated by veteran character actor Edward Herman, who at the time of filming was fighting brain cancer himself. In fact, he died December 31st. Goodman was in Tulsa last night for a benefit showing, and he spoke with me while he was here. Barrett Goodman, welcome to Studio Tulsa, and congratulations on a really, really strong documentary.
Thanks so much, Rich.
Give us a sense of what you and the people at Florentine Films were going through when you said, let's make a documentary about this really incredible biography. But, you know, when you think of it at first glance, a biography of cancer, how do you make a documentary film about this?
Sure. I had all those trepidations when Ken Burns called me about 2.5 years ago and said he had this incredible project, but he didn't have the time to make it himself. Would I be interested? Of course, it was thrilling to be able to work with him. But yeah, I mean, the idea of working for 2.5 years in this field with this subject, obviously death and heartache are part of it. But what I discovered pretty quickly was that the news is good out there. There's so much hope in the field right now. There's so many kind of exciting discoveries going on that it is not a bleak story we're telling at all. It's actually a very hopeful story, and I hope that people who watch it will come away with that.
But as a documentary filmmaker, you know, at the beginning of episode three, you say, this has been the history of cancer, that throughout the last century or so, with every new advance, we say, the end is in sight, or, you know, a cure is in sight, and cancer proves to be a remarkably resilient, effective disease.
A wily foe, absolutely. But, you know, that's absolutely true, that the history of cancer has been this kind of ebb and flow, this sort of zigzag course. But it's a little deceptive because the truth is that with every one of those failures, every one of those sort of punctured balloons where we think we've got it and then we find out we don't, we've learned something very important. Until it's fair to say that by now there's been a revolution in understanding of cancer. So in previous sort of eras when people got up and said, we've got it now, we've got the secret, they really didn't have a basis in scientific understanding to be saying that. They had an intuition. They had a gut feeling. Where we are right now, though, is that we know this disease. Just the other night, a world-famous cancer researcher said to me, we know this disease better than any other human ailment. We understand it better than any other human disease. So that's a foundation of knowledge from which we can build. And so it's really consensus in the field that the second revolution, the revolution in treatment and therapy, is coming. And in fact, we're already in it because we're already seeing new therapies rolling out that are revolutionary.
Yeah, targeted towards the actual cells that really go haywire.
Exactly. I mean, for decades, for hundreds of years, in fact, the therapies that were arrayed against cancer were so blunt. They were essentially either poisons in the form of chemotherapy. They were surgery, which was ineffective against any cancer that had spread beyond a local area, or radiation, which, as we know, caused cancer as much as it fixed cancer. So they were very blunt instruments. But what we've now moved into is a more rational era, an era in which the treatments that are being given are targeted specifically at exactly what's wrong with a cancer cell and more or less spare healthy cells. The greatest, the most exciting new frontier is called immunotherapy, and that's using the human immune system. When you think about it, The reason cancer is so difficult is that it's evolved over billions of years to this point where it is, as you pointed out earlier, extremely wily and difficult. Well, the immune system also has been, you know, honed over billions of years. And so that's fighting fire with fire. The immune system has the ability to, now we're discovering, has the ability to really match cancer, you know, sort of trick for trick. And it's a very exciting time.
One of the doctors that you interviewed, and this is the really interesting, is a lot of the innovators are still with you. So you have first-person interviews with a lot of these. Robert Weinberg, who's discovered the first human oncogene, he was talking about this process, and I think it goes to this new discovery. He says, and he uses a great car analogy. He says, you know, you have oncogenes, which is like the accelerator being stuck, and then the tumor suppressors go bad, and that's like the brakes going out.
Right. Only the last 30 years, essentially, have we discovered exactly what causes cancer. It was a complete unknown. Even by the mid-1970s, they were really in the dark. And this is a great detective story that we get to tell in this series. It's the greatest medical detective story ever told. And as Weinberg describes, what they discovered was that broken genes are the reason that we get cancer. How do those genes get broken? A lot of different ways. Smoking, ultraviolet light, you know, viruses occasionally, or just random copying errors. But the way they're broken is those two different ways. They're either stuck in the on position so that they keep growing, cells keep growing and growing and growing, or the genes that are needed to stop growth are broken. So the brake pad essentially goes. So you have this image of this car running out of control, and that's exactly what cancer is.
Now, how much medicine did you know going into this?
None. I mean, I was a rank, you know, layperson, amateur.
Your previous efforts didn't really prepare you for this.
No, and I had, you know, I like a lot of people. I was kind of, I liked to read the science, you know, articles in the paper. They were sort of cool, gee whiz. But I really didn't understand very much at all. And in fact, cancer was just sort of this disease that struck people, and there was something about cells I really didn't know, which was great, because then if I could understand it, if these brilliant geniuses could explain it to me so I could understand, I was pretty sure that I could explain it to everybody else. It's an advantage sometimes not to know, because you can hit the right level and you can make sure that things are translated in such a way that ordinary people can understand them.
Well, as you mentioned, Ken Burns approached you. What was his driving motivation for doing this particular film? Because this is a very different film than I think I've ever seen from his company.
No doubt. What Ken has said over and over again is that he is who he is because he lost his mother to cancer when he was 11 years old. He never remembered a time she wasn't sick and he didn't see her sick. And then when she died, of course, that had a tremendously, you know, sort of transformative impact on his life. And in fact, he says a lot of why he, quote, wakes the dead, as he puts it, is because of the loss of his mother. So this was very personal for Ken Burns. And I think, you know, he would have moved heaven and earth to do it himself, but he literally is scheduled out for the next decade. And Ken and I, we had never worked together before, but we share a certain filmmaking DNA. We sort of do things in more, you know, sort of a similar way. He needed a filmmaker and he called me and you know, I was thrilled to get the call. I was also somewhat concerned because how would this work? You know, I have my style. He has his style. He was incredibly gracious about giving me the space I needed to make this film, but being there when I needed him. So that's how it worked.
Well, we see a sense of your style from the very opening frames because in the very first episode, before you start telling us the beginning history of our battle against cancer, you start out with a contemporaneous story, a really amazing opening sequence where we meet Olivia Blair, who is, what, 14, 16 months old?
Right.
Who has leukemia.
Parent's worst nightmare.
Yeah, and you open with this very poignant scene.
It was a decision we made really early on with Ken's blessing to feather through the whole series, really to weave through these stories of real people going through these harrowing journeys with cancer. Children, adults, old people, it's a whole variety of people. We didn't know what outcomes they would have going in. We didn't know where the stories would take us. But it was very important, and these people to me are heroes, that they open up their lives to us, that they let us in so deeply at the most painful and scary moments of their lives. And we're right beside their beds, you know, during all of it. There's one patient who dies in the film. We thought that was important to show. That's what cancer is. There are several that live because that's also cancer. Many people are beating cancer, and we wanted to show that. But it was absolutely essential that this history that we're telling, the story that we're telling, be punctuated by present-day case studies. And they really resonate with each other, right? I mean, they really talk to each other, the past and the present, in an amazing way.
What's really amazing is how the past and present in the history of research of this disease talk to each other, because really what you find out is, with only a few exceptions, nobody's been dead wrong on this disease. It's just they weren't dead right, if you will. And they were, you know, there's things that, going back to the very beginning days of cancer research, that have become a part of this building blocks, and it was just like, you know, it's not 100% right.
That's exactly right. I mean, that's, Rich, that's the way science works. I mean, it's the little glimpses that eventually add up to a picture. Or as Sid Mukherjee, who is in the film and whose book this is all based on, Sid says at one point in the film, it's like the blind man and the elephant, that old story where, you know, each person has the sort of their hands only on one part of the whole. And then when you step back, you see the whole. And you see the whole elephant. And that's exactly kind of what happened more or less in the mid-1970s till today. We're finally seeing the whole elephant.
And episode two, which that's the title of the episode, you go through viruses. For a while, viruses were thought to cause all cancers.
Right.
Well, it is a part of some, mm-hmm. but not all.
Right.
Environment, cigarettes, obviously, and there's some really interesting things is seeing this old footage of doctors and patients. And
yes.
Where did you find this material?
We had some.
Is this old television shows, or is it more like documentary films or newsreel films?
Those, I think, were newsreel. There's one, I know what you're referring to. There's one hilarious section where there's a doctor trying to explain cancer to a patient. And he's pontificating about cancer, and all the while he's smoking a cigarette.
Right.
And he's sort of saying, well, ma'am, there's a lot we don't know about what causes cancer, as he's puffing away. And she sort of looks at him and says, do tell me more. You know, that just illustrates perfectly how little was known about it all.
Well, give us a sense of some of the real heroes you got to meet, because you did meet a lot of researchers, a lot of Nobel laureates. And what's really amazing is, it's one thing if you're a clinical person, you have to explain to laymen this remarkably complex disease. It's something other entirely for a researcher who's working in rarefied air, being able to explain so easily to laymen this very difficult research.
I was blown away by the brilliant men and women cancer researchers we were fortunate, privileged to interview, how well and simply they could explain difficult concepts. But I think I was even more inspired, if it's possible, by the doctors and nurses we met. And these people who work on the front lines of cancer every day, especially the ones with children. I mean, can you imagine having to every day go in and deal with sick children like this? It's amazing. And we're privileged. I think one in particular really moved me, and that was a woman named Dr. Suzanne Cole, who was at the West Virginia Charleston Area Medical Center until very recently. She's moved to Oklahoma City. She is a remarkable, and she's emblematic of the remarkable kind of idealism a lot of these folks have.
You do focus a lot of time on Dr. Cole. Was that just as you got to see her and see her in action, you said, oh, this is a story we have to tell? Or was that always the plan to tell an oncologist's story?
A little bit of both. I mean, we decided early on we were going to embed crews at two hospitals, Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, which is a leading kind of research hospital where everybody's on a clinical trial and everybody's experimenting. But then we wanted something more typical. So we picked a very good hospital in West Virginia, the Charleston Area Medical Center. And we went down there with crews. We just sort of got their unbelievable cooperation. And we went and we kind of were in the halls every day. And we met this wonderful doctor. And as we watched what she did, it just became plain to us that what she was doing every day was something we needed to get across to people. We needed to show that. You know, she was one of only 8 oncologists on staff, so she sees every kind of cancer. And most of the patients she's with, because, you know, the healthy ones kind of go home, the sick ones are the ones that stay in the hospital. So she's with stage 4 cancer patients. She's with people for whom there really are no more options. And the scenes you see in the film of her, the way she talks to these people, sort of helping them navigate their choices and their limited choices, frankly. The compassion she brings to it, the humanity she brings to it. It really, if you don't get a tear in your eye watching this, you're not really watching, because it's really, really moving stuff.
Yeah. And the limitations are not just therapies. A lot of times it's money.
Exactly.
As well as therapies. And this is another story of cancer that you bring out in the course of the films.
Exactly. It was something we couldn't avoid. The price of cancer drugs now is so high. The last dozen or so cancer drugs are all priced over $100,000 a year. And what's especially sort of awful about that is that most of them don't work very well. Most of them only prolong life a few months. And so these people are forced into this calculation of
cost-benefit analysis.
How much more time for how much more money? It's a really terrible position to be in. And I hope it won't last much longer. I think it won't. I think these drugs are going to get better and better. And so as they do, and as pharmaceutical companies can kind of have a better batting average in the drugs they produce, those prices will come down and the calculation won't be as excruciatingly difficult anymore.
Yeah. Well, one of the things you do show is Dr. Cole advocating palliative care, which is a new part of cancer treatment, the decision to not try to cure, but to make the remaining days as fruitful as possible.
Palliative care was something that for a long time doctors and hospitals shied away from because it felt like failure. It felt like we're giving up. But of course, for anyone out there in your audience who's had a relative who's died from cancer, they know that fighting it and fighting it and fighting it to the very end is sometimes not a very good option. You bankrupt yourselves, you go through terrible pain and discomfort for, again, maybe a few extra months of not very good life. And what people like Dr. Cole realize, and others now increasingly, is that for that subset of patients for whom there is no treatment or therapy, there are better ways to manage the end of their lives. And she brings all of that information and compassion. She's not pushing people either way, but she's hearing them and she's letting them make their rational choices rather than just be herded one after the other into the next clinical trial, the next drug. And the end of their lives can be very, you know, uncomfortable and painful and not very happy. And so, as she says in the film, there are other ways of healing, not just curing, but actually giving people a better death can be a kind of healing as well.
And she really has to read people very well because she's reading the person to say, is this a fighter who wants to fight to the bitter end that doesn't want to hear that? And if so, I'm going to adjust what I say to them based on that. Or do I have a realist who says, what's the best outcome and is weighing the options, or somebody who's given up? I mean, she really tailors her talk for...
Absolutely. Yeah. And she has to be just so exquisitely sensitive to their wishes and not to in any way impose her wishes or her... Because doctors still have this sort of aura, of almost godlike aura for a lot
There's
of patients.
There's one patient where they basically are throwing
whatever
it in her
lap. Whatever you say,
yeah.
And she can't... That's not a position she wants to be in or can be in, so she has to then turn it back. She wants to inform people of options, but not make the decision for them. And that's an extremely difficult, line to walk. And I just think that she in particular, but a lot of the doctors we saw and were with, have learned to do that brilliantly.
My guest today is Barak Goodman, the documentary filmmaker, director, co-writer, and producer of Cancer, The Emperor of All Maladies. That will be showing this coming Monday through Wednesday evening on PBS, on OETA here in Oklahoma. And he's joining us today. You had a special screening of the film here in Oklahoma, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Along with the cost for patients, you're also in a situation where this film doesn't take a market position, but it sort of leads us back into cancer funding research. You certainly show the history of how this has been a priority going back to President Johnson, to President Nixon, and there's a montage of presidents who all say, we're out to do this. But in real terms, basic cancer research funding has dropped by about a quarter over the last 10 years.
That's exactly right, and this is not a partisan issue because the war on cancer was started by a Republican president, President Richard Nixon, and there was a 30-year period in which there was a bipartisan consensus that basic cancer funding should remain at high levels because basic research was absolutely necessary to get to a cure, and there's nothing humanity needs more than a cure for cancer. In the last few years, the budget for the NIH, the NCI, the National Cancer Institute has been caught up in the budget wars in Washington, and as you point out, their funding has been absolutely drastically and disastrously cut. And what's really awful about that is that this is the moment, right now is the moment, where we are poised on the brink of more progress in the next few years than have happened in centuries up to now. We have the information, we have the data, we have the knowledge. We just need the money to get us over the hump to therapies. And that's exactly the moment that we're putting the squeeze on funding. And so if you talk to cancer researchers, they're really desperate at this point to get some of that funding restored so that young people entering the field will have jobs, they'll have a route to success rather than be turned away and go to other fields. Right now is a real pivotal moment. It's a crossroads, and we can either stride confidently towards, you know, a very bright future, or we can, you know, turn away from that, and cancer will continue to be with us as it is for a long time to come.
One of the earlier things we were talking about with how doctors were so against palliative care, you showed that through the history of this disease, there's been that sort of reaction to a new idea. And you tell the story of Bernard Fisher and lumpectomies as opposed to radical mastectomies. And you kind of go through this whole history of three or four times in the history of this disease where a doctor gets a new idea, and it's not that it's discounted, it's attacked.
It is. I mean, and I don't think this is unique to cancer. It's sort of the way science works. You know, there are these blind alleys that science goes down, and everyone kind of follows the leader down these blind alleys. There's a glimpse, and it just shows you how little was known about cancer. But there was this operation called a radical mastectomy. It wasn't just that the doctors, the surgeons, took women's breasts off. They took the underlying tissue. They took lymph nodes. They took muscles. They took ribs out. It was an absolute excavation of women's chests. And that was done because they thought that that was the way to get all the cancer. They didn't understand that cancer can, you know, metastasize just a few cells, can leapfrog anybody's incision. And
systemic rather
right,
than...
Right, systemic, exactly. Yeah. So they thought, if we just cut enough, we'll get it. And everybody thought this. And this lasted for about 100 years, almost 100 years. The entire profession was certain that this was what to do. And nobody put it to a test. Nobody put it to a clinical trial until this maverick doctor, Dr. Bernard Fisher from Pittsburgh, who is the kind of guy who just does not accept received wisdom, right? He just says, wait a minute, we don't know what we think we know. And he actually put it to a test and discovered that just taking a lump, the lumpectomy, a tiny little part of the breast, could be just as effective as this radical surgery. And that was the death of radical mastectomies. And women owe this man an enormous debt of gratitude. And it really shows you how science, you know, works in cancer and other things. It takes sometimes this sort of outsider to come in and puncture the balloon and say, it's not what we think. Let's look over in this direction. And suddenly we have a whole new approach to cancer.
Dr. John Baylor is another one like
Absolutely.
That. He was the first doctor that really said the emperor has no clothes, because everybody was touting this progress, and he was looking at cold hard statistics, and it showed that no, in fact, the death rate was from cancer was going up.
He comes along in the mid-1980s when there's so much built-up sort of desire for the war on cancer to work. It's almost, you know, this sort of the desire tilted everyone's perspective. And everyone said, well, it must be working. We must be making progress. And he actually did the statistical analysis and discovered that we're not. And the important thing about his work is that he really wanted the field to go in the direction of cancer prevention, which it hadn't even really thought much about at that point. You know, his point was, if we can stop people smoking, that's going to save many, many more lives than these kind of quixotic therapies that really haven't paid off. And he turned out to be dead right. We have saved more lives with smoking cessation, cancer, you know, prevention of cancer through stopping smoking, than we have through any other means. Now we're sort of finding out that there are therapies that work, but for a long time, the therapies were not the way to save people from cancer. It was really cancer prevention.
And yet the idea that we're going to have a magic drug is proved more elusive than actual. There are some that really do a great job on certain cancers, but as your film makes very clear, cancer is a disease of mutation,
right,
and it is very mutable.
it's evolution sped up. What's really amazing about cancer when you think about it is it's a perfection of our own drive to survive. Our cells want to grow. Well, these cells grow out of control. These cells would be immortal if they didn't kill their own host. In fact, there's a very famous story, Henrietta Lacks, your audience may know it. Her cancer cells were kept alive outside any human host, and they are immortal. They've lived for now, her descendants of her cell lines are, you know, 70, 80 years old and still growing. The point is that cancer is essentially us unrestrained. And that's what makes it so difficult. And there is no magic bullet. I mean, there were a couple of drugs produced at the end of the 1990s that were so specific and so effective that they sort of made everyone think that we're going to conquer this disease in the next few years simply by creating more of these kinds of targeted drugs. Well, cancer simply mutates around these drugs. And no one or two drugs are ever going to cure cancer. There looks like the possibility of overcoming this resistance with multiple drugs at the same time. That's one of the very exciting new frontiers of cancer, is combining these drugs into cocktails, a little bit like AIDS, actually, where you can stop that evolutionary process in its tracks. So that and the immunotherapy I mentioned earlier are the two most exciting kind of new frontiers.
Before we finish, I have to ask about one of your other subjects that you follow in the film. That's Dr. Lori Wilson. Mm. Now, were you following her as an oncologist?
No, we didn't. Yeah. She is a breast cancer surgeon herself who then gets breast cancer. We met her, a very unusual form where she has two different kinds in each breast. It's almost unheard of. We met her right after her diagnosis, and it just was just one of those odd coincidences that she herself was a breast cancer surgeon and so had kind of both sides of the equation. I just was with her the other night. She's doing great. She is one of the most brilliant, eloquent, appealing people I've ever met. She's a wonderful, wonderful human being, and you see that. It just comes right through the screen, how much she cares about her own patients as a doctor and how much she has learned about how to deal with them through her own disease. You know, she talks about how much it's changed her in the way she helps her own patients through their pain and difficulty, because she's now gone through it herself. Mm. It's a wonderful story. It sort of dominates the second episode.
Yeah. Well, we wish you great success with this film. It airs Monday through Wednesday on OETA, Cancer, the Emperor of All Maladies. Three parts, three two-hour episodes. And I assume you've been having these targeted screenings around the country. What has been the reaction to the film so far?
The reaction is off the charts. I've never had a reaction like this. The cancer community, the community of researchers, patients, they are so excited by this. I think it's... So they're finally getting some attention. But everybody who's seen it has found it, you know, instead of being kind of disgusted or revolted by the subject of cancer, it taps into all our common humanity. It is exciting detective story. It's life and death. It's a serial killer on the loose that we have to capture. And it's really affects people. I could not be more pleased by the reaction we've been getting.
All right. Barrick Goodman, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rich.
Documentary filmmaker Barrick Goodman speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He is the producer, director, and co-writer of the new PBS documentary, Cancer, the Emperor of All Maladies, which will air Monday through Wednesday evening on OETA and PBS nationally. For more information on the film, visit cancerfilms.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.